Hello, everyone, and welcome to minute 10 of season 10 of Movie Around Minute, the daily podcast where we hijack our way through the 1974 classic film, The Taking of Pelham 123, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again to finish off this week is Stephen J. Rubin, a screenwriter, an author, a podcaster, a producer, and above all, a film historian. Welcome back to the show, Steve.
Great to be back, Rob. I'm ready to take another trip down memory lane and through the subway halls of under New York City.
All right. That's important. That's what we're here for, isn't it?
Absolutely.
So minute 10 begins with the train getting ready to move and ends with Garber meeting his guests.
Members of the Tokyo subway.
Yes. Well, we actually don't even find that out today, but we'll see. So we ended things yesterday with Mr. Blue and Mr. Green getting in the cab with Denny Doyle to start giving him instructions on what it is that they're supposed to be doing here. And when Mr. Blue feels satisfied that everything is right, he turns and he goes, "All right, Mr. Green." And he goes, "100% Mr. Blue." And he says, "Get moving, will ya?" So it's a little interesting, the back and forth between the two of them, that they call each other, you know, Mr. Blue and Mr. Green. We talked a little bit earlier in the week about the fact that, you know, they're using these code names, but we don't know their history, we don't know their background or anything like that. But to be in a situation like this and needing to constantly remember, the names of who you're supposed to be referring to, and not, Reservoir Dogs gives us a little bit of insight into how that works, because, you know, Joe tells them the whole time they need to make sure to only refer to each other by these fake names. Don't give any information about yourself and all that stuff. You know, to make it flow easier, because, like, if you were to tell me, okay, from now on, call me Mr. White, you know, I might blurt out Steve at some point, you know, because it wouldn't be natural for me to say Mr. White. But here you have these two characters. Again, we don't know who's the real mastermind behind everything. I would say 50-50 chance that it's Mr. Blue, as opposed to having some sort of person backing them.
Mr. Blue and Mr. Green have probably the closest relationship of any of the hijackers, because as we talked about last time, Mr. Brown, you barely hear him because he does stutter and he speaks very little. Mr. Gray is in his own world. He's not exactly a member of the team in classic sense. He's a powder keg ready to explode. And I think Mr. Green, for Mr. Blue, is at least someone who you can communicate with, and they communicate nicely together. Although I agree with you that Mr. Green never quite loses his nervousness, because he's not even sure he should be there.
Right. Right. And again, I like the way that they do that, and they have these characters. But again, to have to constantly remember in this type of situation a fake name, it must be that the only way that he only knows how to refer to him as Blue.
Right.
Because otherwise you'd think that it would be blurted out at some point or whatever from that perspective. So again, I like the way that they set that up for us here with the whole thing.
Considering we later learn his real name, I don't think it would have been nearly as effective for Martin Balsam's Mr. Green character to suddenly say, "Bernie!"
Probably not. probably makes sense that he wouldn't want to do that. And the train starts moving along the track, and you know we get a panning shot of the people on the train. And what's fun about doing this movie minute by minute is that throughout the course of this movie, you know, we're going to start being able to recognize who these these little characters are, you know, who the hostages are. Because when you watch the movie, you don't really get much of a sense of it, because it's all rapid fire and stuff like that. But here, you know, we're going to be paying a little more attention to it. So it's nice for them to show us all of these, you know, a panning shot of all of these soon to be hostages, I guess you can call them, for lack of a better phrase.
We should mention Peter Stone's name, because Peter Stone was the one who adapted the novel. And I have to say that being a scriptwriter myself, I really, really worship at the, you know, at the feet of people like Peter Stone, because the dialogue in this movie is so crisp and so perfect for their characters. And I know we're not discussing the Walter Matthau character and his whole world over there at Transit Cop Land, but every time anybody speaks in this movie, there are no there's no dead words. Everything has a meaning to it, and it's very well done.
Yeah. Well, again, it is related to the fact that the novel was written so well, even though the adaptation that he did here changes a lot of things, but he's still able to keep it you know, fresh and moving constantly. You know,
you've encouraged me to pick up the novel now to read it and find out how the transfer is. It'll be interesting to hear it. What did I recently read that I was curious about? I read The Asphalt Jungle.
Okay.
Which was adapted into that terrific John Huston film from 1950. Mm-hmm. And I enjoyed that very much. Very much. It's always interesting to see where movie source material is. And I'm reading a book right now.
In that case, which one do you think is better?
I think the they're different animals. Movies are you know, a little different animal, but I like the I like the movie. I like the movie very much. That's on my heavy rotation in terms of seeing it. So I see The Asphalt Jungle at least once a year, and I have it on audio tape. I have a little hobby I've mentioned to you before, that I tape full-length feature films onto audio cassette, and I play them either when I'm shaving or when I'm, you know, brushing my teeth at night or whatever. And that's how I learn the dialogue. It's helped me as a screenwriter, just in terms of understanding what good dialogue sounds like. And it's inspired a lot of my work. Before I could, you know, I was in high school, I was learning, you know, a lot of this stuff, because I was taping movies like The Great Escape and Bullet and 3 Days of the Condor, all those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, do you still tape them, or you actually now digitally record them?
Shockingly, I haven't in a while. Frankly, in the last 20 years, I've found very few films that I needed to have on audio tape. I think the latest film I have right now, I have The Martian, the Matt Damon movie.
Okay.
I think is a terrific movie. But
yes, yes. And I think they did an amazing job adapting that novel to the screen.
Yeah, no, exactly.
Because, you know, the idea of taking a novel which deals mostly with the thoughts of a particular character, and then finding a way to make it, you know, make a 2.5-hour really interesting, you know, movie, just worked so well.
Oh yeah. Yeah. That is the exception and not the rule of current movies. I mean, we've talked about Tarantino's movies, particularly the last one, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Why don't you have Once Upon a Time in Hollywood on a cassette?
I have it on a cassette.
No, because you said the last one was The Martian. Martian came out 4 years before that. So
yeah. Okay, well, so obviously I was incorrect. Don't pay so much close attention to what I'm saying.
Isn't that what I do here? I'm trying to pay attention to everything.
No, you are a forensic analyst. Absolutely. No, I The Martian and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood are one of the few films I've put on audio tape lately. That's definitely a just like the concept of a classic. You and I both know there are probably 2,000 films that could be declared classics, But I don't think any of them in the last 20 years. It's like we've forgotten how to create classics. I used to want to go out and find the Blu-ray or the DVD of a current classic, and I just there's not a lot of films. There are good films being made, but I would not consider them in the same sentence as The Wizard of Oz, the original Ghostbusters, The Asphalt Jungle, films like that.
Okay, so we are all waiting for Steven J. Rubin to bring that movie to the screen, so we can see that latest newest classic, which I'm looking forward to eventually seeing your 12 Anxious Men, but that one I don't think will be listed as part of the classics, but I know you have that idea in you, and
Well,
I'm waiting to see it come out.
I have a number of comedies that I have the potential of being classics, depending on how they're executed. And we as writers, we just hope for the best, but we'll see what happens. I not only do I look for classics, I'm hopefully trying to write one or two or ten. Billy Rebeck, my writing partner, and I are determined to sell. At a time when nobody, as I've mentioned, it seems to be buying a lot of originals. So we'll see.
Okay. I obviously always wish you good luck with
Thank you.
that.
And by the way, if you bump into somebody who has a couple $1 million in discretionary income and they're saying literally to you, find me a screenplay, I want to invest in a movie, you know who to call.
Okay, well the only person that it, where I live that I'm probably gonna bump into that's like that is Tarantino. And I don't
Have you, by the way, have you bumped into
I haven't bumped into him, but I did see him at a film festival 4 years ago, and I invited him to be on my podcast, and he politely declined. I give him a lot of credit.
He's married to an Israeli woman, right?
Yes, he is.
And how many kids?
Think two.
Two, okay.
I think two, but I've heard of people that have been like in a movie theater and bumped into him, in Tel Aviv or things like that. Again, I didn't bump into him. I positioned myself to talk to him at a film festival, and I'm still very proud of myself after 4 years, having the courage to actually, invite him onto my show, expecting him
Listen.
to just say, "Get out of my face." But instead, he goes, "Thank you, but I don't think it'll work out." So again, it was a
There
polite way to.
is an art to approaching celebrities. There is an organic art. Yes, you have to be very careful. You have to judge the room, the situation. I have always been comfortable around celebrities because I've worked with them for so many years. But I know that some people can suddenly be a nuisance. And the last thing you want to do to these people is become a nuisance.
Yeah, of course.
I was at a party once and I was writing the Twilight Zone Encyclopedia. And I saw J.J. Abrams, the director, from a distance. And I realized that if J.J. Abrams gave me a little blurb for the back cover of my book, that would be a boon. So he was standing there talking with the lady who ran Star Wars for many years. I think she just
Kathleen
gave up the
Kennedy.
mantle. Kathleen Kennedy. They were having a long talk, and it went on and on and on. And finally, J.J. Abrams broke away to go to the car place to get his car. And I knew that J.J. Abrams is maybe one of the biggest fans of the Twilight Zone ever. He just is a Rod Serling freak. So I cornered him, talked to him about it, and would you believe he wrote me a blurb for the book?
Wow, very nice.
So that was very nice.
Yeah, that's great. And have you spoken to him ever since then, or not?
Not really, although I'm thinking of contacting him again to get him on the podcast. We'll see how that works out.
Very nice. Good luck with that.
Thank you.
Okay, so we're back on the train, and they give us an outside view of the train of someone who apparently just got off the train and will be very relieved shortly when he finds out that the train he just got off was hijacked.
Good timing on his part.
Seriously. And then the shot changes and we are in a busy office area, and we hear the phones ringing, and we hear someone tapping on a window, and a woman a woman comes into an area, and she starts tapping on the window, and we see Walter Matthau, who's sitting outside of this glass area, and she then hands him a blue piece of paper, which we don't really know what's written on that piece of paper,
This is Lieutenant Zachary Garber. And he's as I recall, he's not exactly dapper dresser. He's basically a transit cop. He's running the desk there. He's in one of the guys in charge of security for the transit system, and his partner is Lieutenant Patrone, played by Jerry Stiller. We'll learn that in the next few episodes. But Garber is one of those salt of the earth law enforcement guys, a guy who's been around New York forever. Of course, Walter Matthau, being a New Yorker, I believe, was around New York forever. He is the core of this movie's New York feel. I mean,
yes.
Lieutenant Garber is very New York. Walter Matthau is very New York. The way they talk, the way they interact with everybody. The casting of Walter Matthau was pure brilliance. And this show would never have been as good with somebody other than Walter Matthau. Because, you know, Walter Matthau is known primarily as a comic actor.
Yep.
But he has played dramatic roles. I think one of the first times I ever saw Matthau, and I don't even remember the title of the movie, but it's with Burt Lancaster, and he's a master of the bullwhip, and he rips the shreds out of Lancaster with his bullwhip. He plays a bad guy, and Walter could play bad guys if he wanted to. I think early in his career,
I've seen that movie.
Yeah, I forget the title of it. It might be called The Kentuckian, because I don't want to confuse it with a John Wayne movie called The Fighting Kentuckian. But Matthau is just terrific. And as I mentioned on one of the previous shows, about a decade before he did The Taking of Pelham 123, he's in Lonely Are the Brave playing the local sheriff. And it's just a wonderful role. Matthau is just pure gold when it came to everything he did.
Right. So The Kentuckian does feature both Burt Lancaster and Walter Matthau.
Okay. So it's The Kentuckian. Okay.
Yeah, so actually, I must be thinking of a different movie then, because I've actually never seen this one. So, so you see, now you've added another movie to my list of movies that I need to see.
There you go.
And you know that I will watch it.
Yes, you will.
I probably will not do it minute by minute, but I will do it. So Garber hands her this piece of paper and says, Shelly, give that to the meathead upstairs, will ya? But it's funny that he's already calling his boss, whoever it is, a meathead. And, you know, this is after Archie Bunker started. So I wonder if they took the idea of calling someone a meathead, you know, from that one, from that movie, from that TV show or not.
You're affected by it. When you're writing, you're affected by all sorts of influences, so you never know.
Yeah, I have to look to see if it's in the if it's in the novel. I mean, again, the novel also came out. The novel came out a year before the movie. So.
Right. Is the novel called The Taking of Pelham 123?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. It is. Okay.
Yeah, it was written by John Godey. Or Godey. Or Godey, and I found out that is actually a pseudonym, not his real name either. What's his real name? His real name is Morton Friedgood.
There's a name.
Yeah. So apparently, John Godey or Goody is an easier selling name to have on a book than Morton Friedgood.
Makes sense to me.
Yeah, I can understand that too. Right. So, you know, then the receptionist leaves and takes the piece of paper, and Garber is just turning around, and she goes up a flight of stairs and points towards Garber, and we see another woman that's walking down the stairs that goes, "Right this way, just follow me." And then she says, "Oh, Shelley, have you seen Lieutenant Garber?" And she goes, "Right over there," and she points to where he's sitting. And she goes, "Oh, Lieutenant." And, you know, he looks around. He does not look very pleased that he's here. And she's being followed by four Japanese men. Typically for this time of films, you know, they have them all walking around with cameras. You know, a little stereotypical for them to do that, but in this movie it actually fits in well that they do that here because it gives Garber a false impression as to who these men are.
Right. He doesn't even know if they speak English. I think he assumes they don't speak English.
Of course, and because they're monkeys. He calls them monkeys.
Monkeys, yeah. He just very disparaging. These, of course, are the members of the Tokyo subway system. Right. They're trying to learn something about our own subway system. If you want to learn something about America, you got to go to the New York subway. That's the most famous one.
Especially on the day when a train gets hijacked. Yeah.
Right.
So is it what they should do or what they should learn not to do? One or the other.
Whatever they learn will be certainly useful if it ever happens in Tokyo.
That's true. And then she says, "Oh, Lieutenant, it's so nice of you to leave your duties long enough to escort our distinguished guests around the facilities." And we end here with like a little smirk from Walter Matthau. Basically, trying to hold it in from saying, "I can't believe that I'm doing this." This is what you convinced me to do? I don't know.
Dun-dun-dun. Dun 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 da da dun. Okay.
All right. So and that's the way this minute ends. Is there anything else you wanted to say about this minute or the movie in general?
Well, I think you've done a great service to mankind by forensically offering this movie minute by minute. You know how I feel about the movie, Rob. It's one of my all-time favorites. No matter how many times I watch it, I always enjoy it because of the great characters.
Okay, and, great. And while you're shaving or brushing your teeth, instead of listening to classic movies, you can be listening to this podcast.
Yes, in fact, I think I have it on. I think I have it on audio somewhere. Yes, definitely.
There you go.
Oh, you mean your podcast? Of course. That's true.
I was talking about mine. Yes. Exactly. All right, so every Friday we have a segment called Fun City Friday, which is a segment where my guests will give their top five movies that feature take place in New York, however you want to look at it. I know that the list can be very, very long, but, I trust, even though you're a West Coast guy, that you'll be able to whittle it down to just five. So why don't you start with your number five and work your way down?
Okay, I'll start with number five. It was probably the first New York movie I remember seeing in the theaters, which is Rosemary's Baby. Mia Farrow, John Cassavetes, Ruth Gordon. Just a wonderful supernatural adaptation of the great Ira Levin novel. A lot of it takes place at a apartment complex, I think originally called the Dakota. I don't think they call it that in the movie, though.
Mm-hmm. Wasn't John Lennon at the Dakota?
Yeah, I think he was in the Dakota. I think that's where he was killed. I forget. The Brampton. That's called the Brampton. Its nickname is Black Brampton because of the number of murders that have taken place there over the years.
My
number four is Wall Street with Charlie Sheen and Michael Douglas, where we learn that great catchphrase, "Greed is good."
Mm-hmm.
very 1980s. My number three is Taxi Driver, Obviously, great Scorsese movie. Robert De Niro just playing a terrific cab driver. A little bit unsettled. Number two, just because I think it's just such a fun movie, which is Ghostbusters. Again, a little bit of a supernatural twinge, but it's a comedy. I was actually on that set because I was charged with making the behind-the-scenes documentary about the making of Ghostbusters. So I was in New York when they filmed it. We were there up on Central Park West in front of that apartment building, which is playing Sigourney Weaver's apartment building. A lot of it was duplicated in LA on the lot. The whole interior of the Ghostbusters penthouse where they are, they greet the arrival of Zool and those terror dogs was shot on a soundstage at Warner. And my number one is a film I just absolutely love with Michelle Pfeiffer and George Clooney, One Fine Day. And the chemistry between Clooney and Pfeiffer in this movie, both of them look terrific. And I have to say that it's one of my favorite rom-coms. And it obviously it takes place on the streets of New York City and is so much fun. I think Holland Taylor's in the movie. Charlie Durning's in the movie. It's a really good movie.
Yeah, no, I like that too. I think it's a great rom-com. And it works really well, especially since, you know, even at the time, I don't think anyone would have thought to put the two of them together in general, because here you have Batman and Catwoman being put together. But I'm trying to think if their ages, you know, I think she's older than he is, isn't she?
That's what I'm thinking. Sure.
Michelle Pfeiffer was born in 58 and Clooney was born in 61. Yeah, okay. So she's 3 years older.
A little bit older. Yeah. Hard to believe that Michelle Pfeiffer is 67 years old. Wow.
Yeah.
That's hard to believe.
Well, it's a fact. It can be hard to believe, but, you know, it's as I always say, it's better than the alternative. You know, we all get older.
We do. We do.
Not much we can do about that one. Once again, we have the daily game called Name That Remake. So let's spin the wheel and see what we get. Okay. This is going to be a very interesting one for me to try and think of a way to describe it. First of all, there's no question about the fact that you've seen this movie. You've probably seen both remakes also. And I don't really even know how I'm going to try to give you a synopsis that's not going to automatically give it away. I might even give it away just by telling you what years the movie came out. The movie originally came out in 1933, and the remakes were in 1976 and 2005.
King Kong.
Exactly.
Yeah, 1933 is almost synonymous with King Kong.
Exactly. Exactly. How would you try to describe King Kong without giving it away so easily? Can you think of a way of describing the plot by not making it so blatant that that's what it is?
A filmmaker and an ingenue actress go back to the jungle.
Okay. All right. I guess that's some way to do it.
Well, where they meet. Where they meet a future superstar.
Exactly.
Talk about movies being too long. I mean, I admire Peter Jackson tremendously. The Lord of the Rings movies are favorites of mine. But his King Kong just goes on forever.
Yes.
And, and when it's good, it's terrific. I think the battle between King Kong and three T-Rexes has to go down in history as one of the great battle scenes of all time between creatures.
Yeah.
But it's just too much too long, much too long.
I agree. All right. So, Steve, would you like for one final time to tell people where they can find you?
I have two podcasts, Stephen J. Rubin's Saturday Night at the Movies. That's J-A-Y. I have a second podcast. And by the way, it's on all the platforms as well as on YouTube. And then I have Tales from Hollywood Land, which I co-host with two producers, Julian Schlossberg and Arthur E. Friedman. And I'm also on all over Facebook. I do a classic film review every Saturday. I have Stephen J. Rubin as a page. I have the James Bond Movie Encyclopedia as a page. I'm also on X and Instagram and LinkedIn.
All right. Excellent. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Around Minute. You can find me on my website, moviearoundminute.com. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter. You can find me on Instagram. And if you feel like sending me an email, you can send it to movierobminute@movierob.net. So, Steve, thank you very much for joining me this week.
It's been my pleasure, Rob. Stay safe back in Jerusalem.
I will do my best. And I will be back on Monday with a new guest. But until then, achoo.
Gesundheit.